Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. I'm going to keep plugging my podcast every week because I am excited and happy with it, and I think that there is some good work coming out on that podcast, and I really would like to get more of you guys onto things that I've done and am working on here that are not just all Scientology related. So this week I did a really interesting interview with a guy named Dan Errol, who is an author and a writer for Pathos. He has a Danthropology blog. Anyway, he and I talk about separation of church and state and some pretty interesting stuff about this guy, Ken Ham. Oh my God, a little bit of a crim, that guy. Anyway, and it was kind of fun stuff. So anyway, if you haven't checked out the Sensibly Speaking podcast, it is on my YouTube channel and is at sensiblyspeaking.com. So there is my plug. I am really enjoying, this is now number 81, episode number 81. God, I've answered a lot of questions and they just keep coming. So you guys keep them coming. You know, I usually do a little thing at the end of the show, but I don't know if all y'all stay to watch that. But I really do want your questions. I do want your feedback, negative and positive. I want to know what you think of what's happening on this channel and with this show and other things that I do. Your feedback helps guide me as to what is working and what isn't. So anyway, thanks for all of your comments and whatnot, whether they're good, bad, or ugly. So, all right, let's get on with your questions now. Dear Racer, back when LRH was sailing about on the Apollo, what were the big established land bases? Please talk about some exciting and interesting missions. Okay, so when Hubbard left St. Hill Manor in 1966-67 time period, he solicited volunteers to come with him to be part of the SEA project, the SEA, the SEA is in the Ocean Project, and he went out and got some boats, and they started sailing around, and when you know the entire history of Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard, you know that he was basically going on the run. I mean, the Scientology had gotten a ban in the UK. There were, you know, people were being stopped from even going into the UK to do Scientology. Tax exemption had been revoked in the United States in 1967, and I'm sure Hubbard got wind of that in 66, 67 when that was starting to go down. And so it wasn't looking like, you know, the future was not looking real bright for Scientology at that particular moment in time. So he decided to go out and do the SEA project, which turned into, within a year, turned into the SEA organization. And one of the things the SEA organization does is it sends out these projects, and they call them missions. They send a couple SEA org members out. They brief them. They get them all jazzed up on what they're going to be doing. And then they go to a remote location, because Hubbard was operating on the ship, which was called the Apollo. And he had a little flotilla. He had some other ships, the Athena and some other ones. And they were sailing around in the Mediterranean and up and down the European coast. And they had various adventures and misadventures and whatnot. And there's lots of information about this time period. It went on for years on the internet. You can find people who were there telling their stories and talking about how things were on the ship and that sort of thing. There were no land bases at that time. That didn't happen until FLAG was established. And that was in the mid to late 70s. I think 76, 75, 76, I think, is when FLAG, they decided to take FLAG, the FLAG ship, which was the ship that Hubbard was on, they decided to take it to land, and they found a place in Florida, in Clearwater, and that's where they set up shop. And that was when there was, you know, land base there. During the time that the Sea Org was being formed and was getting into operation is when the Sea Org bases started being formed up. So maybe what were the big established land bases? Well, there was the Advanced Organization in American St. Hill set up in Los Angeles in 1969. That's also around the time that they set up Celebrity Center. Although that's not really considered a land base, but it's, you know, it's a Sea Org organization. It's manned up by Sea Org members. That's also the time period, I think that's when they set up, that's definitely when they set up in Copenhagen in Denmark, and they set up the Advanced Org and St. Hill organizations there. And I think that's when they set up in Australia, and I think that's in Sydney is where the Sea Org base is down there. excuse me. So, and then of course there was FLAG and, you know, and the one in LA, and I think those are the main bases. So that's when those were set up. As far as exciting and interesting missions, you know, I'll tell you a couple things. I mean, one, there was Mission Into Time, which I think most people know about, who know much about Scientology, but it is where Hubbard was in the Mediterranean, and he decided that he was going to test out his whole track recall. In other words, his recall of things from past lives. And he was sure that he had been a prince back on the, you know, back way, way thousands of years ago on the Mediterranean, and that he had buried caches of treasure, you know, around. And he thought he was going to get these things dug up. So Sea Org members went out on his instructions as to where to dig, and they went out to dig up this buried treasure. And as far as I know, from all accounts that I've read and seen, they didn't find anything. And there's a whole book that was written called Mission Into Time, which talks about this whole misadventure. And sort of, you know, yeah, we found, you know, exactly what the Commodore, that's what they referred to him as, Hubbard was the Commodore. We found what the Commodore, you know, described in the tower and the pit and the this and the that. But, you know, what they didn't find was any gold or treasure. So, kind of a, you know, big failure. The other kinds of missions that are not talked about a lot, and in fact, I was told this story when I was in the Sea Org by another Sea Org member who was there. She said that they were sending missions out, these projects, and they were demanding that the orgs make money, right? And they would go out there with these intense demands to make money, like right now. And they actually brought, okay, now this is crazy, okay? But she told me this was true. And I thought, what? Even when I was in the Sea Org, I thought this was insane. But she said they brought chains with them. And they would not symbolically, but actually chain the registrars, the salespeople, to their desks until they made their quotas. And these people would be there day and night. Now, I have never heard of this outside of this one Sea Org member in the Sea Org telling me that this used to happen. You know, she told me they used to, I mean, she was telling me stories, you know, internal Sea Org stories that were pretty wild. I mean, you know, guys, some captain of the Advanced Org who used to walk around carrying a gun. I mean, they just crazy, crazy stuff. You know, guys used to be, she said it was, she was regaling me with stories of the old days, like how crazy it used to be and how much better it is now. And this was, you know, now being the time that I was in management and I was getting yelled at every day and we were having these intense conferences and getting pushed around, and I mean, it was bad. It was not fun at all. And she's telling me that it used to be so much worse, right? So I'm like, wow. So, So I was aghast that people were being chained to their desks, right? And I even said to her, how could they go along with that? That's just insane. And she was like, well, you know, when you're clearing the planet and you're, you know, and Scientology is the most important thing. And it's amazing to me that this conversation happened in the Sea Org, amongst Sea Org members. You know, this isn't some ex telling me about this, right? Some ex Sea Org member. Anyway, that was a pretty wild story. And if any of you guys who are listening have corroboration of that or know of just as crazy stories, I'd love to hear it. Put it in the comments section. Or send me an email. I'd love to know about little secret stuff like that that's never really gotten out to the light of day yet. You know, just these things that happen to individuals that maybe weren't, you know, there's no Hubbard policy anywhere that says chain the person to his desk. So you're not going to, You're not going to dig up some Hubbard instruction somewhere to do that. And yet that happened, right? So maybe there's other stories out there like that. You guys let me know. But that's about as interesting and exciting of mission stories as I have to tell. Steve Willis, what do you think of the WikiLeaks documents on Scientology? I've read some of the OT materials, and they seem legit and Hubbardian. However, as a never-in, I want to know if they are good sources in your eyes. And Jennifer Brewer, for your next video, what was your reaction on first reading the OT3 materials? Yeah, I believe that the OT materials on WikiLeaks and that you can find online are legit. They're written in Hubbard's handwriting, and there's enough documentation and there's bulletins and policy letters, that some of which I've seen that are not confidential included in the packs, along with the confidential stuff. And it all definitely reads like Hubbard, and it sounds like, you know, Hubbard, and it looks like, handwriting-wise, it certainly looks like Hubbard. I understand that the materials that are on the internet are from the 80s, and there have been some changes to the OT levels since that time, in various revisions and whatnot. Little things, I think, for the most part. You can find the older OT levels, the original OT levels from the 60s and 70s, also on the internet. So you have two different sets of these things called OT levels. You know, OT 1 and 2 and 3. 3 has always been 3. That's the Xenu story. But OT 1 and OT 2 have changed over time. And then there was 3 and 3X, and then it went to 7. And that's a whole little weird sequence that happened in the 1960s and 70s that was kind of put to the side. And now there's just OT 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And I think they call them on the modern grade chart, I think they call them new OT1, new OT2. OT3 has always been OT3, and, you know, new OT4 and that sort of thing. So I think that's how you could differentiate between them. Some of the information I know, like the L rundowns and some of the power stuff, there are levels called power and power plus. I think those are predominantly put together by my memory of the people who were trained on them, who came out of Scientology and wrote it all down. So I don't know how accurate those things are, which is probably one reason why I haven't talked about those a lot. I've been asked about Power and Power Plus, and I've been asked about the L rundowns, but I'm not sure how legit what's on the internet is. And again, if any of you guys, I'm kind of soliciting for comments here, but if any of you guys know, you know, whether they are spot on or not, let me know, because then I might grant them a little bit more legitimacy and talk about them a little bit more. I just haven't been sure, because I never did the OT levels, I never did the L's, and I never did power. So, you know, so that's so all of my confirmation of these things comes from other people who did them. And that's where I wrote my chapter in my book about all the OT levels. I confirmed all of that information with people who had actually done the OT levels. I talked to a number of people on that line. Now, as far as my reaction to the OT3 materials, I'll just tell you straight up, I was pissed. I first found out about and was kind of stuck to the mystery of OT3 practically the first day I walked into an organization. I had been raised with Scientology, but I had never really knew too much about these confidential levels. My parents never really said much of anything about them, of course. My dad alluded to a couple weird sort of things about Mars and Venus and stuff like that, but never really came just flat out and said, here's the story. Because he, you know, he couldn't, because it was confidential. So the first day one of the first days I went into an organization after I got sold on Scientology and wanted to get going on it, one of the staff there gave me this Hubbard lecture called RJ67, Ron's Journal 67, which is his briefing in 1967 to all the public about OT3. And he doesn't tell you anything about Xenu, he doesn't tell you anything other than there was a great catastrophe that occurred here and amongst the planets of this federation, I think he calls them, or confederacy, 76 trillion years ago, or however many years ago it was, 75 million years ago, whatever, blah, 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 blah. And And he says, in this place, this has been a desert ever since. And you go, wow, what was this big catastrophe? What happened? And people just kind of, within Scientology, just sort of smile at you and say, well, you'll find out when you get to OT3. And it's sort of this big mystery, right? And that's how OT3 is talked about in the Scientology world. So for 27 years, I never knew what this OT3 was all about. And it was, you know, really, really interesting. Like, I wanted to know. So when I was going down the rabbit hole on the internet and finding out how horrible, you know, Hubbard was and Miscavige and all that stuff, after I had left the Sea Org in 2013, I got to the point where I knew I didn't want to do Scientology anymore. I didn't want to have anything to do with this stuff anymore. It was a con and I knew it. And that's when I went, you know, let's see what all the excitement and fuss is about. And that's when I got the OT levels and I read them. And I was very upset because they were not logically consistent with the lower levels. The OT levels had a lot of information in them that left more questions than answers. I was expecting a lot of answers. And what I got was a lot of gobbledygook and a lot of illogical bullshit. And then the whole Xenu story leaves more questions than it does answers. And if you want to know what I'm talking about, it's all in my book. I'm not going to sit here and read the whole chapter to you because it's too long. There's a lot of inconsistencies and things that just don't make sense in those levels. And I didn't just read OT3. Of course, I went to that first. I watched South Park, then I read the actual material. Then I read all the OT material that I could find on the internet. And it just really pissed me off because I had really felt like, I mean, I had sold people these OT levels when I was in the Sea Org. I'd been stuck like glue to them for all those years, thinking that the secrets of the universe and the mysteries of life would be unraveled for me and everything would be answered. All my questions would be answered. Well, that's not anywhere close to what happened. And I was very, very disappointed. Very disappointed that this was the big reveal in Scientology. So that was my reaction. I do not know how to pronounce this name. What's the single most difficult adjustment to the real world you've had to make since leaving the cult? When I first came out of Scientology and started speaking out, people noted over and over again how fast I had recovered, how fast I'd gotten over the mind control and that sort of thing. And it sounded nice, and at first I went along with that and agreed with it and thought, yeah, that's kind of cool, you know, because I was speaking out so quickly and so avidly against it. It seemed like I had broken down a lot of barriers, you know, mentally and psychologically, to a lot of the Scientology controls that are installed over the years. And there's a certain degree of truth in that, but the thing that has been most difficult has been realizing how much is still there that I've had to come to realize and overcome as I've been going. It is not a black and white thing. It is not, you know, you are in the mind control. Oh, I'm out of the mind control now. And I'm totally free and I'll never be part of any of that ever again. That's not how it works. It's a gradual process as you come to realize for each, and I think this is very individual for each person. There's no like one size fits all process to do this recovery from a mind control thought reform situation. You know, Lifton describes the kind of thought reform that occurred in the 1950s in Maoist re-education camps with Americans who had been stuck in China and had gotten wrangled into these re-education camps, and had then coming out and him analyzing that and looking at what had been done with them, and the fact that you could tell from his descriptions and what they were saying that some of these people were going to be recovering from the processes that they had been involved in some cases for a couple years. It was going to take them, you know, a long time to get over it. And that has been what I have been finding for myself and for others as well. But in terms of me, you know, it taking me a year and a half before I realized that I had some emotional issues with not being able to experience them fully, the loss and the grief and some upset that I had had, that I had suppressed so hard. I'd been pushing it down for so many years that I had kind of forgotten how to express grief and loss and some of the anger that I'd been feeling. And not even realizing that for a year and a half, you know. So, and that's happened enough times that I've come to realize that there could be another, you know, layer of the onion skin coming off anytime. Anytime it could happen, you know. Oh, a whole new level of bullshit, you know, coming off as something occurs to me in life or in a conversation or in educating myself about it. Oh, there's a whole new layer to this, right? So I think the most difficult thing for me has been not knowing what's coming next, you know? And, you know, you just do your best and you go along in life and that's what I do, you know? And I share with you guys what my experiences are with this and what I've learned and you know, and that's where a lot of my video content has come from. And I guess that answers the question. Benjamin Johnson. Most Scientology watchers focus on how few Scientologists there actually are. But shouldn't we be talking about the dwindling staff numbers instead? For the past few years, the LA org has been staffed exclusively by Sea Org members. The Ideal org in Atlanta was practically begging people to join staff in the weeks leading up to COB's arrival with his giant ribbon-cutting scissors. And the handouts at recent Scientology events inevitably ask attendees, when can you join staff, and when can you join the Sea Org? In previous videos, you said that most local churches have at most 200 to 300 parishioners, with maybe 100 actually active. But you also said that a fully staffed org needs 100 plus staff members. Where are these staff going to come from? Will the LA Org be the model? As more and more Ideal Orgs open, will more and more Sea Org members be shipped from Flag and Southern California to work in Buffalo, Cincinnati, or that stadium in Twin Cities? Are there enough Sea Org members to go around, or will there be more recruiting drives in Eastern Europe, Asia, and South America? Fancy uniform, $50 a week, sign me up, new American friend. Thanks and keep up the good fight. Okay, Ben. Yeah, I agree that the staff numbers are dwindling. When the new Ideal Orgs are open, let me just throw everything off the top of my head here. When new Ideal Orgs are opened, Sea Org members go into the area and recruit up as many people as they can and throw them on staff, put them in a uniform, and they do the ribbon cutting, and chairman of the board is there, and wow, look at all these staff, and everybody's happy, and it's great. Well, he takes off that day, and within a couple weeks, definitely by a couple months, according to what I saw with my own two eyes in Twin Cities, a lot of those staff disappear. They just fade away, right? Turn in the uniforms or not, and they just go, right? Because they're not making any money. The promises that were given to them about coming on staff don't come to fruition, and they just get sick and tired of it, and they leave. So a lot of these Ideal Orgs are down to, you know, maybe when they opened they had 100 staff, but now they're down to 30, 40 staff, right? There was a woman who had just the other day left staff at Inglewood, and she said there were like 35 staff in the day org and like 40 in the foundation org or something, nights and weekends. So they dwindle in size. And, you know, Twin Cities, I'm sure, is down to, you know, maybe 25, 30 staff in the day and the foundation, right? I mean, they just shrink. Back down to, see, the whole push to make the Ideal Org happen is just a bunch of fakery. It's a bunch of smoke and mirrors. Scientology is not expanding, it's shrinking. And these Ideal Orgs are it's just lingo. It's just Orwellian doublespeak. They're not ideal. They're not wonderful. There's nothing great about them. And nothing is changed with those organizations except a big building. You know, there's no new training coming in. There's no revelatory Hubbard policies found that suddenly, oh my God, this is it. This is what's going to boom Scientology everywhere. You know, every year or two, these mantras come down from management to the poor staff, and they get treated to this, you know, this is it, this is going to be the thing, and they've been doing this since the 80s, right? And it never happens, because Scientology is just a con. Anyway, so the staff numbers dwindle. There are probably enough Sea Org members in the world to send them out to these orgs and man them up with Sea Org members. There's about 5,000 Sea Org members, so you could probably do it. But I don't think that's what's going to happen. I think what is more likely is that they will double down on the Sea Org bases and make those the central Scientology centers of service and delivery, which is kind of what's happening now. It's been going on for probably really about the last 10, 15 years that real concentration is moving in on Flag, Los Angeles, right? Sydney, these bases I talked about. And most of them are tiny. I mean, you know, they're not very big. Flag is really the only place where they're really making money. LA, Sydney, St. Hill Manor in East Grinstead, Copenhagen, those places are not moneymakers. You know, they're barely keeping afloat. So they're already, you know, centralizing activities into these bases. And I think that if they had to start closing these orgs, that's a more likely scenario than they're going to send a bunch of Sea Org members out to them. They might, in desperation, send Sea Org members out to man up a few of them. And they do send out Sea Org members to run them, right? They'll send 4 or 5 Sea Org members out like they did with Buffalo or a couple other places. I can't remember all of them off the top of my head, but there were a few places where they send what they call a command team. And they send 4 or 5 Sea Org members out there to run the show. And then it's up to them. They're just kind of left out there. And you make it happen. And if it doesn't happen, they get all the blame. And then they go to the RPF and some new Sea Org members are sent there. Or they'll recruit some local idiots and they'll be the executives now. I think that's what happened in Buffalo. And, you know, and this cycle just kind of goes on. So they'll use Sea Org members to sort of bolster or keep the orgs open for a while. But as far as fully manning them like they did with LA Org, that would surprise me. I don't think that's what's happening. I don't think that's what's going to happen. I think for the most part, Miscavige has given up on most of the city level orgs. And, you know, they're just kind of left to fend for themselves and throw up whatever money and be places where the IAS regs can go and the vultures and suck up as much money as they can and then go back to the Sea Org bases. And I think that's kind of the operating pattern at this point. Kristen Olson. Hi, Chris. I wanted to let you know that it is difficult to navigate through your channel to find Q&As, for an example, where you have answered a previous question. You often say that you don't want to repeat your answers. I understand. However, how am I or we to find the answer? Thank you. Yeah, this is no big deal, Kristen. What you can do is go to my blog. Every week on my blog, which is mncriticalthinking.com, link below in the description of this YouTube video and in every single description of every single video that I've made is a link to my blog, mncriticalthinking.com. Every week on the Q&A shows, I post the questions that I answer on my blog. And you can search it. It's searchable, right? So you can go to my blog and just go to the search box and enter in whatever question or subject matter it is you're looking for, and it will pull up the Q&As or videos that have that search term in it. You can also do it from Google. I try pretty hard to, you know, to put some SEO into my blog. So, and I myself have searched Google for questions that I know I have answered and pulled them up that way. So if you're as a particular subject like, you know, David Miscavige violence or something, or, you know, power processing, right? You could put in, you know, Chris Shelton, power processing, Q&A, and Google will do its work for you and find what you're looking for. So I think that is the best way to go about looking. Every question I've ever answered is on that blog. I don't put the questions in the description below on the YouTube channel because I put them in my blog. And I don't know, maybe I secretly want people to be going to my blog. So I don't put them in the description below. That is, I hope, an answer to your question. And if it's not, email me or leave me a comment and let me know, and I'll address this further. Okay. Nick C. From my reading, I understand that prior to the Miscavige takeover, Scientology had missions, which were in business speak, independently owned franchise outlets. Some of them had been financially successful, which was one motive for Miscavige to cut out mission holders. That's what they were called, right? By, again, in business speak, converting franchises into corporate-owned outlets. In that, Miscavige was aided by a Scientology outfit called the International Finance Police. Who were these people? What did they do? And what happened to them after the takeover? Does this outfit still exist? Was it dissolved? Or did they go the way of the Guardian's office, morphing into something bearing a different name but serving essentially the same purpose? Okay, Nick, here's the deal. The Guardian's office had a bureau or branch of it that dealt with Scientology finance. When the Guardian's office dissolved and collapsed in the late 70s, a lot of the legal and PR work that they were doing went over to the Office of Special Affairs. The finance part of what they were doing went to the finance police, the International Finance Police, under the finance, international finance dictator. I mean, they didn't even try to soften or, sugarcoat what the finance police were doing. And the finance police did go into the Scientology missions, and this is a different use of the word mission from what I was talking about with the Sea Org before. These missions are franchises. They were small operations that were given the rights to use Dianetics and Scientology terms, and 10% of their income was sent up to Hubbard every week. Hubbard thought that they were greedy and that the missions holders, the people who own those franchises, were ripping him off. So he had them extorted from. He had the finance police go in to these missions and basically empty out their bank accounts and take all their money, and under threat of declaring them suppressive and fair gaming them, right? So, and this was in the early 1980s. So this is when the church was, this was incredibly heavy strong arm tactics. This is all on record. A guy named Don Larson was a finance police person. He's made videos. He's you can look him up on the internet. The man who ran the International Finance Police, as far as I could tell, is a guy named Wendell Reynolds. I met him when I was in the Sea Org. He did a mission into, a Sea Org mission this time, into a project into the LA area when I was a management staff member there, and I met him then. He was quite a bit different from how he's been described in the 80s. He was very toned down and pretty chill on the mission he was on with us. But back in the 80s, he was like, they literally threw these mission holders around, sat them down in a room, put them on an e-meter, had, a whole gaggle of Sea Org members standing around them, pressuring them, where's the money? This kind of thing. I mean, it was intense. And Wendell Reynolds was the guy who ran this this outfit. And what happened was sometime, and I don't know exactly when, sometime probably in the 1980s or 90s, the finance police became the finance network. They started sugarcoating it. And they have representatives at every local Church of Scientology called a finance banking officer. And then at the finance banking officers at the church levels run all the money of the organization. They're the ones who control the bank accounts. They're the ones who control how much percentages of money are going up and down. The finance banking officers are run by, at a continental level, the continental finance director. And he, in turn, is run by the international finance director. So that's, and Wendell Reynolds, as far as I know, was the international finance director when I left, or he was up in that international finance office. And I was never really closely connected with the finance guys when I was in, so that's as much as I know about it, is structurally that's how it's laid out. Last I heard, Wendell Reynolds was in the hole under David Miscavige, pliantly crawling around on the floor at David Miscavige's whim. So, karma. So that's what I know about the finance police. Whoa, it's Flash Answers time. Ah, indeed. My question is about FLAG. If a person was in the Bay Area, FLAG seems like it would be a potentially interesting tourist attraction, even for someone with a limited knowledge of Scientology. However, I have read reports about surveillance, including cameras that will capture license plates and people being followed. In your opinion, is it safe for a WOG to go down there and spend a few hours looking around? I guess by Bay Area, you mean the Bay Area around Clearwater, not Bay Area as in San Francisco. And no, I wouldn't go down there. There are cameras everywhere. Your picture will be taken. If you're driving around in that area and you circle the block more than once, they absolutely are going to take pictures of your license plate and run it. And they're going to want to know everything about you. They are an amazingly suspicious lot, especially over the last few years. The paranoia and the wagon circling sort of, environment. They're circling the wagons. They're like, they're hunkered down in Scientology right now. And they're very paranoid. So, you go spend a few hours wandering around down there, they're going to want to know all about you. And they might even come up and ask you who you are and what you're doing, what your business is, and that sort of thing. So, I wouldn't go down there if you want to stay out of their crosshairs. Iridian. Why do you not identify as an agnostic atheist and only an agnostic? Everyone is an atheist or theist given the definition of the words. You either remain unconvinced there is a God, atheist, or think the burden of proof for the existence of God has been met by your standards, theist. You can be unsure if a God exists while also not being convinced that one exists, the null hypothesis. I think that most people don't understand that Gnosticism speaks to what you can know, while theism speaks to what you believe, and are not mutually exclusive given the definition of the words. I hate labels. I'm done with labels. I'm not using any labels for me and my beliefs, because there's just too much controversy over what the labels mean. So I've described on this show many times my beliefs, what I think, what I hope, what I know, and what I think I know, and what I know that I don't know. And however, whatever label you want to use to describe me, knock yourself out. Peter W., how does Scientology view L. Ron Hubbard's sci-fi novels? Are they avoided as fictitious stories that would blur the lines between the truth about Xenu and intergalactic empires, or are they praised as seminal works? I personally have only read only one LRH short story and found it utterly dreadful. Okay, Peter, first off, most people don't know anything about Xenu, and so no one in Scientology avoids L. Ron Hubbard's stories because of blurred lines about Xenu. Hubbard actually claimed in lectures that all writers were pulling their stories, including him, I suppose, from their own past life recalls and memories. So there's that, right? I never liked Hubbard's fiction. I enjoyed Battlefield Earth when I first read it. I did not enjoy the Mission Earth series. I thought they were horribly inane and way, way, way too long. I never enjoyed his short stories or his pulp fiction. I gave it a real go numerous times because other Scientologists would tell me how great they were and how wonderful they were and how awesome Hubbard was. And I never, never could get into it. So it's all really a matter of opinion. But a lot of Scientologists sort of pushed the idea that Hubbard was a great writer because, of course, they have to. Okay, and so we have come to the end of another week of shows. I answered a lot of questions this week. This is a longer one. I hope you guys appreciate it. Leave me your notes, feedback, comments below. Consider supporting my show and my channel and me. You guys are the ones who enable me to do this work. Without you, I am nothing. At least this channel is nothing, because the only way that I can afford to keep putting the time in to do the research, to do the writing, and to do the videoing of these things is the time that you guys actually buy me through your support. And that's no bullshit. So I hope to get more support and love from you guys too. Thanks a lot for coming around. I'll see you guys next week.